live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government with a local update on SNAP benefits. Travel turbulence ahead with the federal shutdown forcing the FAA to slash air traffic by 10% at 40 airports nationwide. New Yorkers may feel the ripple effects, even if the only airports directly hit are downstate. If you're flying out of the city, we'll let you know what you should brace for. The Sullivan County School District just lost a major First Amendment fight. A federal appeals court says it went too far when it punished a student for a George Floyd-related post made off campus. What does the ruling mean for free speech in schools? We'll learn more. Plus, a preview of the latest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call with Tom Candela. That's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Aviation Administration is acting as the government shutdown drags on. The FAA will gradually reduce air traffic because of staffing shortages. That reduction will rise to about 10% by the end of next week. Chris Sununu is the president of the trade group Airlines for America and the former Republican governor of New Hampshire. He says the reduction is about safety.
It's about being proactive and making sure that the American public knows it is absolutely safe to book a flight. It is absolutely safe. We slow the system down to ensure that safety, right? Because you don't want it to get to a critical point. So everyone's putting in the overtime. It's not going to be easy, but all the airlines are stepping up and doing everything they can to make sure that customers aren't just being hard canceled. They're being moved their flights when they can.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Stocks opened lower this morning as another monthly jobs report goes missing. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid about 230 points in early trading.
For the second month in a row, the Labor Department's report on employment and unemployment has been held up by the government shutdown. The department number crunchers, who ordinarily assemble that report, are on furlough, along with hundreds of thousands of other federal workers. The shutdown's also straining already shorthanded air traffic controllers. Airline stocks are dragging as the FAA ordered airlines to scale back flight schedules by up to 10% at major airports. Tesla shares opened lower after investors approved a mammoth pay package for Elon Musk. The CEO could receive up to $1 trillion worth of Tesla stock over the next decade. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has appealed a judge's order to fully fund the government's food assistance program this month, despite the shutdown. The judge had told the administration to start funding the food program today. He'd ruled the government failed to consider the harm to people who rely on the benefits. The shutdown has forced federal workers to go weeks without a paycheck. Some community organizations are stepping up. From member station WAMU, Jackson Sinnenberg reports on how one school district in the Washington, D.C. area is helping out.
Arlington is the first Virginia suburb you hit west out of D.C. and home to the Pentagon. It's a hotbed for federal employees. That's why the superintendent of Arlington Public Schools asked the district to come up with ideas to help families. One solution, serve dinner at three schools while the shutdown lasts. Arlington Public Schools' Frank Bellavia.
When you think about communities, you think about the schools that are there, and these are really are the backbones of the community. So us being here and doing this meet is nothing different.
The school system plans to serve 250 meals at each school every weeknight for 30 days, or until the shutdown ends. For NPR News, I'm Jackson Sinnenberg in Washington, D.C.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 160 points. You're listening to NPR News. New York Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik has declared she'll run for New York governor. Stefanik's a strong supporter of President Trump. He originally nominated her to be his U.N. ambassador. But congressional Republicans worried if Stefanik left her seat, they could lose their narrow majority in the House. Political candidates in several high-profile races this week supercharged their online ad campaigns to reach young voters. But NPR's Anusha Mather reports that in-person contact may have made the difference in New York City.
Zoran Mamdani spent the weekend before the election riding the subway and cheering on marathon runners. According to his campaign, he had over 60,000 volunteers knocking on doors. Ruby Bell Booth is an analyst at the research organization Circle. She said this grassroots campaign was crucial to support among young voters.
There's an assumption that they're just all on their phones all the time, but we actually find that the most important resource for young people when thinking about politics is their friends and peers.
Booth says Mamdani's support among young voters sends a message to other candidates. To get young people to the polls, a savvy social media campaign is important, but ultimately no substitute for face-to-face connection. Anusha Mather, NPR News.
University of Florida basketball player Olivier Rioux is now the tallest person to ever play in a college basketball game. The 19-year-old from Canada made his debut last night in a blowout win for the Gators. Rioux is 7 feet 9 inches tall. Guinness World Records has declared that Rioux is the world's tallest teenager. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, as you heard from NPR News, the Trump administration has asked an appeals court today to immediately halt a judge's ruling that would require the government to fully fund food stamps. This ruling said that this month's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, benefits for roughly 42 million Americans must be funded by the end of the day. The latest development, once again, plunges the program into confusion and chaos. For a local perspective on SNAP benefits, we're joined by Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, who joins us every Friday with an update. Let's start with that. There is more confusion and chaos today. We thought that these benefits might be at least partially funded, but now we're not really sure what's happening. What's happening in Monticello when it comes to SNAP benefits for Sullivan County families in need?
Well, we're still expecting that there'll be partial payment. Whether or not there'll be full payment, that's what's being hashed out in the courts right now. But the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, which handles these payouts, has already indicated, and Trump's team has as well, that partial payment will be coming. So at this point, we're still anticipating that sometime between the 12th and the 14th of November, SNAP recipients will start seeing their EBT card accounts get refilled, but probably only around 65% of what they would normally get. And even that, the calculation methodology is something that is causing our heads to spin as to how is that all working out. So I'm not here to tell people it's going to be exactly 65%. I really don't know. And states have had to rework their systems. Some states, I think, have very outdated old systems. So I'm not sure that those folks in those states will get their SNAP benefits this month at all. But here in New York State, we've been told sometime between the 12th and the 14th, people can start expecting to see their benefits come in.
Normally, they would receive those benefits sometime between the 1st and the 10th of the month.
So correct.
Are you hearing from families, or is the Health and Human Services hearing from families that are struggling and in need? And how are they coping?
We are, but not as much as the food pantries, which actually to me is a sign that we've been successful in letting people know food pantries are the place to turn to. For this, we've been hearing from a number of pantries. I'm sure you've heard from like a Single Bite and the Food Bank of Hudson Valley and stuff. Their requests have skyrocketed because people are very worried about them and their families going hungry, as are we. We have been telling people who get in touch with us, too, though, that there is public assistance that comes through the state that is still available, but you have to apply for that if you're not already on it. And you have to do that online or by visiting our social services office in the Travis Building in Liberty in person. We can't take those over the phone.
And in John Little's United Sullivan partner update that he sent out yesterday, he was mentioning that there are already actions that the county is taking, including what you just mentioned, like letting folks know through social services. Community resources has increased the county's regular purchase of food for local pantries from the Hudson Valley Food Bank. And then also mentioning, other local efforts to help households. And just to put it in context, and we've spoken about this before, but about 12,000 Sullivan County citizens are receiving SNAP benefits across a little more than 6,000 households.
But when you think about that in percentages, that's about 15% of the county's population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, not insignificant.
It is not.
And folks are, you know, in need. What are, you know, there's a list of food pantries on your website. We have a link to food pantries on our website, not only in Sullivan County, but also in the other counties in the region. Yesterday, Legislator Kat Scott noted that food pantries are in need for more than food these days. They need money as well.
Yeah, actually, the reason for that is that they can purchase food more cheaply than you or I can. And a lot of times they get a whole bunch of canned goods, but they're trying to, as John Little told me yesterday, to give people three square meals a day kind of thing, the material for that. So just giving them food may not necessarily meet the immediate need that these pantries have, whereas giving them money means that they can buy at wholesale prices what their clientele, the people who are coming in, need at any given moment. So if you're looking to donate towards it, money is more useful to them than food. And I'm not here to shill for any particular food pantry. I'm not allowed to. But you know the pantries that you like, support, to find out the ones in your community. We have it listed on our website, on JFF's website. And maybe give them just even a few bucks, you know, $20 will go farther with them than you could at the grocery store.
And yesterday also in his United Sullivan Partner update, Commissioner Little mentioned, as you did, a single bite. They say that not since 2020 have they seen such desperation from local families. They're recalculating all of their food needs to prepare for a 35% increase in meals.
Yep.
They are asking the community to help with financial support and also to volunteer. Those are other ways you could do that. And again, reach out in the best way you think you can help. But it is, I think, important at this time to help our neighbors.
Yes, especially since our research indicates that most of these folks who are on SNAP are working. Mm-hmm. These are not people who are mooching off the system. Of course, every municipality has a few of those folks, but it's been very disturbing for me to see on social media and elsewhere mm-hmm. where people are making the assumption that these folks simply aren't working and all they need to do to feed their families is to go out and get a job. It's not that simple, and we should not lose our compassion amongst our community in that fashion.
Also, as a result of the ongoing federal government shutdown, there's more impact to HEAP, the Home Energy Assistance Program. Now, that was going to be delayed, but now it's completely delayed until further notice. We thought that it may be in November, mid-November, it might pick back up.
Yeah, November 17th was when we were originally told that HEAP applications would start being accepted, the new ones. But now the season is on hold indefinitely. You can still apply. You can still talk to our HEAP office if you've one of those who had the early applications. We still have all that on file. You don't need to reapply for it. But we don't know when we're going to be able to give you that benefit because until the shutdown ends, we simply don't have the funds to provide that benefit. So if the shutdown ends at some point, I'm sure very soon thereafter we will get a concrete date. But the state has now told us rather than trying to set another date like they did with the 17th, they're just saying it's indeterminate.
What if folks are in an emergency situation? Is there any emergency aid available? Mm-hmm.
Yep, there is emergency aid, again, through our Department of Social Services, as I said, but also we have a community assistance center. This has been operating since the pandemic. It sort of lost its high visibility after the pandemic because people weren't as in much need as they were then, but now they are again. And we want to remind people that that's available. We can connect you with food and shelter and other assistance just by calling 845-807-0925. That's 807-0925. If nobody's there to answer, leave a message. Your call will be returned.
And is that just for information or is that for...
No, we can connect you with resources. We have food right on site. If it's an emergency need and you're having trouble getting in touch elsewhere, we can help out with that.
Other public assistant benefits are still available through the state, but mm-hmm. you have to apply online.
Or in person at our social services office in Liberty.
Right. Let's also talk about the Community Assistance Center, again, still operating. You mentioned that number.
Yep.
And other benefits that they offer there for folks who may be in need for?
Yeah, the Community Assistance Center, we just ordered, and I think we got it delivered, triple the amount of food that we normally have. So we have that on site. We're over at the transportation building near the county airport, a very centralized location. But also, they get calls about shelter, about heat, and we can put you in touch with the right people right away for those needs. So that's why it's called the Community Assistance Center, the CAC.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. Let's talk about a big event that happened this week. It was the election.
Oh, that's right.
Right. an off-year election, but as we mentioned before, all of the seats, not all of the seats, but the majority of things that were happening are local, a lot of local races impacting mm-hmm. folks, you know, directly. And how was turnout this year?
Turnout was okay.
Yeah.
Depended on where you were. Some places were stronger than others. It wasn't as much as we ever hope. I mean, we put a lot of effort and time into our Board of Elections does into creating as smooth and accessible a voting process as possible. So they really want to see people turn out. I do too, because it's democracy in action. And it always astounds me that more people turn out for a presidential election than a local election, because these local elections affect you much more directly and immediately than presidential elections do. We all get hyped up about the presidential elections, and I'm not saying we shouldn't. But these local elections, and a number of townships had races for like supervisor or town judge or something. These are people that you might even know, that you'll meet, that you may have a concern to address with. So I wish we had seen more. That said, we had a lot of folks turn out, and I'm grateful for those people who have taken the time to vote. We are still counting votes. There are absentees that are still coming in. There are write-in votes that, even though we listed on our election results on the website that there were write-in votes, we didn't list exactly who they went to, because those have to be counted by hand. They actually have to have our election commissioners look at those and see, you know, what they write in. Was it an actual candidate, or was it something like we get Mickey Mouse. Donald Duck and those kinds of things? So we got to sort through all of that. But they've told me, the Board of Elections, that as those results get counted, that they will be updated on the website where we're posting the election results over the next probably week or two, I would say.
Yeah,
it may take longer if there's court challenges for anything, but I haven't heard of that yet.
Yeah, these are unofficial results, as we've reported as well. And any particular races where an absentee or write-in vote might impact? Are there any close calls there that they're keeping an eye on?
Nothing that I'm absolutely aware of, and especially since you're still not sure how many absentee votes are going to come in on certain races. So I am sorry I don't have the answer to that question at the moment, but I would say most, from what I saw, most of the races are pretty clear cut. But then again, I'm not the one that's there counting the absentee ballots, so I'll get back to you.
Please do. Come next Friday. We noticed also that there, in particular in the write-in candidates, they didn't, you know, no write-in candidate won, but they certainly had more of an influence, it seemed, mm-hmm. in the election, which in itself is says something in the sense that you got to convince people to write your name down.
Particularly, I think, in the county sheriff's race and in some town of Fallsburg races, there was a big, big push, bigger than I've seen in my years as both a reporter and a government observer, for write-in votes. And I think that showed that there is a potential for write-in candidates more so than people normally think that there will be, because there was a strong showing for write-ins. Of course, we've got to wait and see who they actually wrote in for, but I would say, based on the amount I saw, that a lot of the write-ins are going to be for actual real people rather than Disney characters or something else.
Your favorite Star Wars character. One of the things I noticed, I voted in person, number 251 in the town of Delaware at the Delaware Youth Center. Shout out to the poll workers there. They were very nice and lovely. And what I noticed on my ballot was there were a lot of folks that were unopposed. And that seemed to be, as I looked at other races, not only in Sullivan, but around, a lot of folks just, you know, not running against, having to run against anyone. Just wondering, you know, thoughts on that and what it says for, you know, just the the slate of candidates out there, the willingness to participate in this democracy at a local level.
Again, looking back on, I can't believe I'm saying this, 30 years of being involved in local government.
So you started when you were 12.
Yeah, no, unfortunately not, when I was about 20. But I started covering for the Democrat local government in 1996. My gosh. But anyway, all that said, this was pretty typical in terms of the amount of contested versus uncontested at the town level. Listen, people have to be cajoled and recruited to run for these positions because it can sometimes be a little bruising, not just during the election, but after you get elected and you're basically now elected to listen to the public and sometimes take their verbal complaints or abuse. So it's not for everybody. And I get why that's not, but we're grateful for those people who did step up, whether they were opposed or unopposed. The fact that they felt strongly enough that they wanted to be a part of the local fabric of democracy means a lot, because if they hadn't stepped up, who would have? So
let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more from Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, including Passport Palooza. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatsco.
What homeowners insurance do you really need, and how to keep it affordable?
One of the subtleties to look for is things like, if a tree does fall through my roof, is this policy going to pay to replace the entire roof or just the damaged portion?
Plus, author Rachel Kushner remembers the Eugene, Oregon bungalow that made her into the writer she is today. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and I'm joined in the studio with Dan Hoost. Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. You know, I'm tongue-tied because you've got something coming up called Passport Palooza. Is this like a music festival celebrating passports? No. What is it?
That's an interesting idea. I should put that forward to the clerk's office. This is through the office of County Clerk Russell Reeves. They had a passport event last time, but we all agreed. It's like, we got to come up with something that sounds more interesting. So they decided on Passport Palooza.
I love it.
Some alliteration there. Sunday, November 30th from 10 to 2, hosted by the county clerk's office. Last time it was appointment only, but walk-ins will be welcome, subject to availability at the government center, to get or renew your passport. And it's just to make it something that is easy for people to get to on a weekend, maybe when they wouldn't be as busy as they would be during normal business hours. So if you bring a photo ID, like your driver's license, your expired U.S. passport, or if you're getting a new one, like a birth certificate or a naturalization certificate, not a copy, the original, and then check or money order, no cash, you can come between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on Sunday, November 30th, and we will process you to get a passport.
All right. Reminder about some events coming up. The Drug Task Force open public meeting is actually today at 2.
Yes.
Tell folks about that meeting.
Yeah, I've said this before. People may say this sounds boring, but actually it is fascinating. You will get to sit in with the group that has got the boots on the ground addressing the substance use, abuse, opioid crisis, whatever you want to call it in Sullivan County, the folks who are working day in and day out to address this issue. It's everything from law enforcement to treatment centers to our public health and social services to advocates to counselors. We have what we call pillars. I think there's 7 or 8 pillars, basically different areas that are handled. But everybody's there talking about it. And they love having the public there because they get to explain to people what it is that they're doing. And the public can ask questions or afterwards interact with some of these people. And connections have been made that could never have been made otherwise or hadn't been made before. So 2 p.m. in the hearing room of the Government Center today, if this concerns you, if you're wondering what we're doing about this or even how you could be involved. You don't have to be involved. You can just come and listen. It's a place to be. 2 p.m. today at the Government Center. It will really change your understanding of how we're addressing the drug crisis in Sullivan County.
Another reminder, next Wednesday, there is a free rabies vaccination clinic. There was another report of a case of rabies in the Manor. Is that right?
Yeah, rabid raccoon near Livingston Manor. There was a couple weeks ago. And so in response to that, our public health department always sets up a rabies vaccination clinic, a free clinic. It will be at the Livingston Manor Firehouse November 12th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. No pre-registration required. The only requirements are that you bring proof that you're a Sullivan County resident, because that's only who it's open to, and that your dog, cat, or ferret are properly restrained so that they are not creating issues with other animals that are there. We'll get you through fast, quick, and easy, and you'll get either a one-year booster or a three-year rabies shot.
And an update on broadband, that fiber trenching has begun. It's in Liberty and also now in Fremont.
And now I just found out from legislator Kat Scott, who lives up in Fremont, that she saw the trucks up there. So, yes, the trenching has begun in earnest, because we have to have this $30 million phase one of the project finished by December of next year. So we are, Archtop Fiber, our private partner, is furiously going around the county trenching. It looks a little messy, might be a little noisy for a short amount of time, but we will restore those properties back to their original condition, and we're only doing it in rights of way. It's not in a place where it would be trespassing on private
And you
property.
Can find out online if it's coming into your area.
Archtopfiber.com has all the information right there. But if you have any questions about it, they also have a phone number you can call.
Will they have to pause for the winter or because of the ground?
I wondered about that too, but I don't believe so. I believe they can continue to go. And there is just a little bit that's going to have to be done overhead as well. And they're going to have to hook up the main cables to our one dozen emergency communication towers, which can be done during the winter as well.
A reminder that the Sullivan County Visitors Association, SCVA, and the county have a $300,000 grant program that's now open. Who's eligible for that grant program?
Yeah, this is actually round one, just open for applications on November 1st. Round two isn't until March. But this is room tax money that the county has made available to the Visitors Association for what's called a Tourism Enhancement Grant Program that the Visitors Association is going to be running. It's going to be open for arts and culture organizations, for tourism organizations, for destination locations. It's a room night focused grants, which is getting heads on beds, as they say, getting people to spend the night here. Arts and culture will be exhibitions, residencies, cultural experiences. There'll be village, hamlet, and micro brand grants to help local chambers of commerce develop distinct visitor-facing identities through branding and wayfinding. And there'll also be events and festival support grants, which will be specifically for what it says, big events, festivals that are going to draw people from beyond the region, especially for those who are going to maybe spend more than just the day here, but overnight.
And what is the application deadline there?
The application for round one is December 16th. And you apply through the Visitors Association, which you can reach out to them on their website, sullivancatskills.com/grants, or contact them via email at info@scva.net.
And a reminder that Tuesday is Veterans Day. There are several events happening around the county. Actually, I think some this weekend.
Yep, they start, I believe, tomorrow or Sunday. Yeah, we have the list on the website, so refer to that, not us.
Yeah, right. But don't rely on our memory here.
Veterans Day is Tuesday. County offices will be closed that day, including the Board of Elections. They weren't closed this past Tuesday because it was Election Day, or the rest of us were, but they'll get this day off too. We are encouraging everybody to get out to these events. If you can't or won't be available, maybe say thank you to a veteran you know, because unlike Memorial Day, which is about the veterans who have passed, this is about the veterans who are still with us, and there are plenty of them.
There are events starting tomorrow in Monticello and Woodburn, on Sunday in Hurleyville, and then, of course, on Tuesday there are several events, and if you go to our website or the county website, you can find out the full list of those celebrations of our veterans in
yes.
Sullivan County. I mentioned that you should come back next Friday, as you normally would, but you're not going to be able to be here next Friday, you told me in the break.
Yeah, I'll be. I'm sorry. You call me a bum, but I will be live streaming a press conference from the district attorney's office about some new interagency collaboration regarding actually the opioid crisis in the community. This is not something that will be, I think, discussed in depth today at the Drug Task Force. It will be unveiled next Friday, 10 a.m. We will be live streaming on the county's main Facebook page.
All right. We'll miss you.
And yeah, I'm sorry.
We'll see if we can muddle through.
You can still talk while you're sobbing, right?
I have years of experience, Dan. Dan Hoos, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, are you flying out of the city soon? We'll let you know what you need to brace for. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar. This week on Farm and Country, if you're a farmer or small business owner yourself, you know that learning how to market your business is essential. But where do you start? This week, we chat with food and farm consultant Eric Hassard about how he's helped farmers grow their businesses sustainably and his tips for marketing your farm. That's this week on Farming Country, Saturday mornings at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As you may have heard, to cope with the government shutdown, the Federal Aviation Administration has announced major reductions to air traffic. Starting today, 40 airports across the country will be required to reduce their flights by 10%. While the only directly impacted airports in New York are in New York City, the New York Public News Network's Emily Watkins spoke with Elizabeth Carey from the AAA Western and Central New York region about how these cuts may still impact travel plans for New Yorkers.
Tell me about the questions you're getting right now or the concerns you're getting from members about their holiday travel plans in light of this FAA reduction.
The number one question we're seeing at AAA is people asking, what time should I get to the airport? Like, how early should I be there? And is this going to affect my flight? So we don't really know if it's going to affect your flight. We have to see how this pans out. But we are reminding people to get to the airport at least 2 hours in advance. Normally, it's 90 minutes in Buffalo, and they usually get people through very quickly. But at least 2 hours to be on the safe side.
For people who are just starting to book their holiday tickets, should they maybe be considering driving or taking a train? Should they be having backup plans? How seriously should people be taking this?
Yeah, travelers should definitely have a plan B just in case to be on the safe side. So if your destination is within driving distance, for example, you're talking Thanksgiving travel, a lot of people go to New York City. You could easily drive there. If you're not capable of driving there, taking the train there is another option. So people looking at different options like that, of course, that quick flight to New York is the easiest way to go. But not if we're seeing hiccups with flights, especially going into those larger New York airports. So we kind of just have to plan ahead and have a plan B.
Are there any protections that travelers should know about in terms of if their flight does get canceled or rescheduled? Is there anything they should know to be able to protect themselves or advocate for themselves in those situations?
So it could get hectic if flights start getting canceled. And so travelers really have to advocate on behalf of themselves. So if you have travel insurance, a government shutdown isn't necessarily covered under travel insurance. But if your flight is delayed and you're going to lose, say, half of your trip, that trip interruption of protection would kick in there. So if you miss a flight because the TSA lines were too long, you wouldn't be covered under something like that. So that's why it's so important to get to the airport early, just in case. So you always want to have travel insurance just for peace of mind, and hopefully you don't need it. Usually it's not too expensive to add on to, say, flights or a trip or something like that. But there is small print, and there's different levels of travel insurance. So those are the things you should consider in a situation like this.
Let's say somehow a week or two from now, this government shutdown ends, but we're coming right up on the heels of Thanksgiving. What's your advice?
So regardless of whether the shutdown is taking place or not, we do expect Thanksgiving to be a busy travel season. AAA's official forecast is going to come out on November 17th. But if it's anything like the holidays we've seen throughout the year, travel has increased year over year. So we know Thanksgiving is always a busy travel season. A lot of people like to travel for Thanksgiving and then even stay home for the year-end holidays. So that's some things to consider, that a lot of people do like to travel and get out and about. And the majority of people do take road trips, but air travel is usually always setting new records. So be prepared, regardless of the situation, for larger than normal crowds at the airport. So that means you're going to want to make sure that you sign up for text alerts with your airline. You're going to be getting updates right to your phone about what's going on with your flight if there's any type of a delay. So that's really handy. And then also make sure the airline has your contact information so they can reach out to you in case there is a change to your itinerary.
Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
And thanks to the New York Public News Network for that update. Now, a federal appeals court has ruled that a high school student's free speech rights were violated when a Sullivan County school district punished him for a social media post. The ruling comes from the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which found that the punishment handed down by the Livingston Manor Central School District crossed the constitutional line when the student posted an image referencing the murder of George Floyd. Jason Dole spoke to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union for more on the story. We should note that Livingston Manor School District is now part of the Rockland Central School District.
So this was a ruling that came down from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit last week on October 30th. And they ruled that the then Livingston Manor Central School District violated a student's rights for disciplining him over what is, by any accounts, a risque, potentially offensive social media post that the student made in 2021 that made, or at least appeared to make, light of the murder of George Floyd. So I can describe the post. It was a photo that was taken after school hours and not on school property, showing the student lying on the pavement next to a car. One of the student's friends was kneeling on his neck. A third student took the photo with the student's phone. And that student who was lying on the pavement posted it on social media with the caption reading, "Cops got another." This was on April 19th, 2021, a date that many people might not remember, but is important because it was the start of jury deliberations in the trial for Derek Chauvin, who's a Minneapolis police officer who was eventually convicted of murdering George Floyd, the previous year. And everybody, I'm sure, remembers what happened after that, that basically catalyzed the big Black Lives Matter fall of 2020 and police reform. In response to this, there was this, it was, well, at least among students, got emails about it, more than 20, according to the court documents, are kind of running the gamut, but many of them labeled that behavior as racist and urged the school to take disciplinary action, which it did. It ended up suspending that student for 5 days, which is the maximum that New York State allows without having a disciplinary hearing, and barred him from various activities for the rest of the school year. And then there were other steps it took as well. It held like a sort of school assembly to address students in grades 7 through 12. And the guidance counselor had some follow-up discussions. They issued a public statement, and they launched 2 days of implicit bias training. I should note, too, that these were high school seniors at the time. We're not naming this kid because he hasn't been charged with anything, even though he was just barely 18 at this time. But, suffice to say, like, teenagers make mistakes. but I would say that, someone who's 18 probably knows a little bit what they're doing with something like this. Nevertheless, the student sued Livingston Manor Central School in state Supreme Court and eventually got bumped up to federal court. He basically said that his First Amendment rights were being violated. And he claimed that he was unaware of the sort of, appearance of the photo. That he said he didn't knowingly realize he was recreating the image of George Floyd's murder. He also said he didn't know that the timing of the post coincided with the start of Derek Chauvin's trial. It's worth noting that, you know, whether or not you believe that, everybody, all the other students who took part in this testified the opposite. They said that they didn't know what they were doing, but they were not the ones who were suing the schools. So the court ended up ruling that it had overstepped its regulation and essentially sent the case back to district court for further proceedings. The federal judges noted that the post, quote, lacked any meaningful connection to the school. So basically what they're saying isn't that, like, this isn't speech that should or should not be regulated, but that because it was off school grounds and because it wasn't during school hours, basically didn't really have any connection to the school. There was no reference to the school. It just sort of spread among the student body and the parents. That the school didn't really have the authority to levy any discipline here.
Right. So essentially saying that this decision was outside of the school's purview, essentially outside of the school's jurisdiction to discipline a student.
Yeah. And one of the arguments that the school made in court documents was that, well, this caused kind of significant disruption within the school community. I mentioned all the emails that they had gotten. I mentioned all of the sort of extra steps they took to address any concerns that students had, certainly to try to address any concerns that those parents had. But the court, the federal judges ruled that the level of in-school disruption that the post caused did not justify what they ultimately ruled as restrictions of the students' speech.
So this moved up the ladder of courts. This got to a federal appeals court. You're not saying the name of the student in question. Have you heard from his representatives or family? Has there been any kind of statement or response to this ruling since they've gone through this whole process?
No, we reached out and did not hear back. We're not really sure exactly what the next steps will be. Like I said, it did have somewhat of a complicated legal pathway. It started in state Supreme Court. It got bumped up to federal court. And the ruling that was being appealed up to the appeals court was actually like a summary judgment issued by a judge that essentially said that there was a substantial disruption and that the school district had acted accordingly. And because it's a summary judgment, there wasn't a full legal process. There weren't hearings or anything like that. Really, all that the appeals court is saying is that no, that's not the proper step. This does need to get remanded down to the district court for further proceedings, and then they seem to limit what role the school district itself could take in that. And of course, there's the further complicating factor now that you mentioned at the top of this segment that this district doesn't really technically exist anymore.
That was Philip Hantuso, managing editor of the Hudson Valley Bureau for the Times Union. You can read more at timesunion.com. We'll take a break. And when we come back, Tom Candela is here with a preview of the theater podcast Curtain Call. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
This week on Cat's Cast, a special session with singer and songwriter Ginger Wynn, a South Carolina native whose work brought her to the Hudson Valley.
When we first came up to the Hudson Valley, and you know, still to this day, we really enjoy working with local Hudson Valley talent. I can see why people like to come up here to record, get away from the city, get away from all other human contact.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and Tom Candela is here. He is the host and producer of our theater podcast, Curtain Call. Good morning. And the new episode drops every Friday. He's here with a preview. And today, it's a preview of a redo, in a way.
Yes, yes. Back by popular demand, actually. We saw back in January, Farm Arts Collective put on this great production called Lucy Joseph, and it was a sold out hit. In fact, people who wanted to see it were unable to see it because it was sold out, and got great reviews in the paper, Jonathan Charles Fox wrote it up. And so they decided to bring it back this very week. No, next weekend, the 14th, 15th, and 16th. And I had the pleasure of interviewing not one, not two, but three of the creatives from the show. I had Jess Beveridge, who's playing the lead role. I had the director, Mimi McGurl, who is the director and the writer of the piece. And also we have some live music on the show for the first time on Curtain Call. Oh. We have some live played music by one of the musicians, Douglas Rogers.
All right, let's take a listen to an excerpt from Curtain Call, the new episode with Tom Candela. Thanks, Tom.
Yep. And today we're headed back to the Catskills, where one of summer's most talked about productions is back by popular demand. After a sold-out run at Farm Arts Collective this past summer, Lucy Joseph returns this November to once again tell the extraordinary tale of Joseph Israel Lobdell. Born Lucy Ann Lobdell, he was a 19th century gender nonconforming pioneer whose life challenged every social and spiritual boundary of his time. Lucy Joseph blends history, imagination, and music to bring to life the journey of a person who dared to live authentically in an age that offered very little understanding. Joining me today are three of the creative voices behind this remarkable work: Douglas Rogers, Mimi McGurl, who shaped Joseph's story for the stage. She is the writer and director of the show. And of course, we cannot forget Jess Beveridge returning to the title role that captivated audiences all summer long. And it's happening right here in our neighborhood at the Farm Arts Collective at the Willow Wisp Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Mimi, Douglas, Jack.
Wow, Tom, that was great. Thank
Welcome
you so
all
much.
To Curtain Call.
Thank you for having great. Us. Thank
so
you.
I'm going to start with you, Mimi. When you first came across her story, what made you say this is something that needs to be told on a stage?
Well, in fact, it wasn't me. It was Stanis Qualcha and Jess Beveridge.
Okay.
They had read William Klaber's novel called The Rebellion of Miss Lucy Ann Lobdell. And they thought, well, that's a local story, and wouldn't it be fun to figure out a way to put it into the three dimensions? And it took about 2 years altogether to come to today, but it's been a pleasure every minute.
Okay. All right. And so what made you think, Jess, that this was a story that needed to be told for this time?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm definitely going to put all the credit. I'm going to give all the credit for making this happen to Tanis Qualchuk.
Okay.
Because she came up with the idea for us to bring this story to life and for me to play this title role. So she really gave Mimi and I the seeds to this project. And then we discussed it with Bill Klaber, who wrote the novel that Mimi was just speaking about.
Oh, you did?
Yes, wow. We did. And he was over the moon excited about it and also gave us a little bit of seed money to be able to start the project.
Fantastic.
So we owe a lot to Tanis, obviously, for being our artistic director, and also Bill Klaber for supporting it. And he was very thrilled with what we put on stage.
Oh, great, great. So, Mimi, how much of it was devised with the cast, with the director, with Tanis, to come up with the final piece that you wrote?
I would say, well, after I read Bill's book, I did a bunch more research, and I found a dissertation about what if Joseph Lobdell was like a 19th century version of a transgender person. And I looked at the case study of a doctor that wrote about having a patient who insisted they were a man. I used the case study, which was published in 1883, as part of our source material. And then there are infinite amounts of newspaper articles and obituaries and so much material from the time when they lived, which was from 1829 until 1912. So they lived a very long life with a lot of important U.S. history happening. And we went through all of the themes that we thought were most theatrically compelling and depictable on stage. And I just did a lot of listening, a lot of reading, a lot of research. Mm. And then I set up like maybe 10 scenes for us to work on.
Okay.
And then I kind of tried to give us a skeleton of work. And I want to mention Mark Dunow as well.
Mm, yes.
He's been like incredibly helpful on dramaturgy, and he's actually just outright written a couple scenes. So I would say overall, a very collective process. I would say I was the shepherd in terms of making everything kind of come together.
Sure.
but absolutely a collective project. Everybody's, Annie and Pam, Doug's fellow musicians, play roles, always coming up with good ideas.
John Roth, don't forget
John
him.
Roth and Laura, incredible character
right,
actors.
Right, right.
And Sam, who's new mm-hmm. to this production, just fit perfectly and has a great voice.
How did you first come to it, Doug? Was it something that you were at the ground level as well?
I think Mimi chose her people that she wanted to be involved in this. And as soon as I had the book, I was immediately knew what kind of musical take we wanted to have with this show. And so that happened pretty quickly.
So for the music, did you have to sort of invent the music for it, or did the piece itself kind of invent the music for you?
Yeah, I would say, because we were talking about the 19th century, I wanted all the music to kind of fit into that 19th century mold. So even though I'm writing music for it, as well as finding some folk songs from the Catskills that are actually from this
area.
That's
so great.
Mm-hmm. We've included that in the show too. So in a way, it had to like jump these eras, the musical eras of the past and the more recent present.
Right, right. When you did this role initially, Jess, did you anticipate that it would go over so well that you would have to come back and add on some shows this fall?
I would love to be humble and be like, oh no, I didn't think that. But yeah, I did, actually. I would love to say that I didn't believe that, but okay. I really think that there was so much buzz around it and so much interest in it. And it's something in a way that's different than what Farm Arts usually does, in the respect that's very traditional, where we've turned our space into a black box theater, and we did it that way. And you're not going around the farm, and you're not being immersed into other different environments. Mm-hmm. So I think that was also a draw for people to be like, oh, what can they do with this space? So I think that was a draw, and Mimi writing it and directing it, she has a wonderful following and so many people that love her as well. So I think it was a huge draw, and we sold out even before we opened.
Right,
which is,
I remember.
Just, it's dreamy, right? So as soon as that happened, we were like, yeah, we have to be able to put this up again in the fall when we all have a little bit more headspace. So we're hoping that all of those people, not only those people that weren't able to see it, come back, but people that come that did see it in June to come back and see it again.
Sure. Okay. Well, the show does examine what we define as normal, right, or acceptable. How did you navigate that to the time when Lucy lived?
You know, can I say just on that topic that I feel like a real theme of this show, and which applies to us because we live here in the Catskills, mm-hmm. is the way nature became a refuge for people who wanted to be themselves. And it's still like that up here. People use this area as a refuge to be themselves and to find freedom that in a stricter society isn't allowed. Nature lets you be who you want to be.
Well, that's a wonderful way of putting it. And it seems to be very much accepted, you know, because your mm-hmm. show is, as mm-hmm. you said, it was a big hit, sold out performances, and people still wanting to see it.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I received very wonderful feedback, mm-hmm. not just from the performances that we all gave, but from the story and how it just transformed into this beautiful piece through fiction and through all of the amazing research that Mimi did. But overall, I feel that it was a really great feedback from everyone. They really accepted it and really enjoyed what we put on.
Yeah.
And at the show in June, we had family members of Lucy Joseph
really?
In our audience, and they already bought a ticket to the next show.
I just love that.
It's really wonderful. Right. And it was like such an honor to see them in the audience and for them to hug us afterwards and to also give us like a thumbs up, like, wow, you really portrayed this really well.
Doug, so in some of the reviews that I read, it said that the music was a character unto itself.
Oh, that's a nice thing.
Yes.
It is a very nice thing.
Yes, it's a character of its own was the quote that I pulled. I believe it was from Jonathan.
Nice. Yeah.
How did you begin composing for Lucy Joseph? What inspired the sound?
Pulled music from different places. Some of it stuff I had written in the past. I think the thing that came through in the work, the music for this, is that it wanted to give it sort of a filmic feel to it. And this is such an emotional story.
Yeah, it is.
And I just felt like, oh, I think I can tag all these moments of the play with a little theme that will bring out the emotion that's going on with the characters. And so I just looked at the kind of the phases of the play, of the story, and thought, okay, this is a theme that would go here.
I actually wanted Doug to create things as he went, and he did. Yeah. He listened, he felt, he watched, and then suddenly there'd be new transitional music or something in the middle. Yeah. Or,
and I know that there was, as we got to the end of the play, I got like, oh, Mimi, there's a song that has to go here at the end, and we have to do it just because it's going to bring out, it's going to nail that emotional impact of this show. So, and
what did I say? What
you
was
said,
my answer?
Do it. There were certainly moments in the rehearsal where we put the music in and it's like, that works.
Works.
So that's the rehearsal process. By the time you get to the performance, you kind of know what's going to happen.
Sure. Do you have a piece you want to play as we go into the break?
Yeah. Let's do the, it takes place in the 19th century in our local area. I wanted to use a song from that period, which is a Stephen Foster song called Hard Times, if anybody knows it. So. Pleasures and count its many tears while we all sup sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, a sigh to the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days have you lingered outside my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more.
Yes. Beautiful. That was Doug Rogers, folk, from the upcoming production of Lucy Joseph, which is going to be presented this November. The dates again?
14th, 15th, and 16th, Friday, Saturday, Sunday at Farm Arts Collective.
Of November.
Of November.
And folks can get tickets by either going to Farm Arts Collective website itself, where they'll certainly find links, or going to myrivertickets.com. Doug, Jess, and Mimi on the phone, thank you so much for joining me today on Curtain Call. It's been a true pleasure, and I do appreciate your support.
And thank you, Tom, for all you do. You are everywhere, and we truly appreciate all the work that you do. So thank you for having us today.
Thank you. I love it.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Thank you.
You can hear the full episode of Curtain Call and past episodes at our website. Just go to wjffradio.org. Click on the Shows tab there on the navigation bar, and in the drop-down menu, click on Podcasts. You'll find it there along with our other podcasts and our Community Voices podcasts that we host as well. WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
There's a battle playing out over who should control American universities.
We're going to bankrupt these universities.
In season one, we were guessing what was to come. Now we know.
We want nothing less than $500 million from Harvard.
It's season two of the Harvard Plan. And this time, it really is personal. Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Last week on Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman reacted to the news that our pets are suffering from boredom.
Yeah. To see a bored fish. Because you're like, wow, you think they have it all. They live in a castle, and still they're as depressed as the rest of us.
I'm Peter Sagal. If your goldfish is bored, have them listen to this week's news quiz with special guest food pioneer Roy Choi. That's Wait, Wait, from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Occasional afternoon rain today. It'll be breezy as well, a high of 51. Rain at times tonight with a low of 43. Looks like it's going to be a kind of cloudy, overcast, and drizzly weekend. Tomorrow, clouds, a high of 52. On Sunday, occasional rain and drizzle, a high 46. And then a cold front moving in at the beginning of the week. Monday's low going down to 23, and Tuesday's high only up to 34. On Point is coming up next from WBUR in Boston. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.